Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 7, and I'm your host, Sammy D'Agostino.
Oh, and I'm your co-host, Josh.
Today we'll be talking with Priscilla and Denise from Hair Story Project. I don't know if you guys, you listeners out there, remember, but we had interviewed Denise and Priscilla a couple of months ago about Hair Story. We're interviewing them again because it is Black History Month, and we thought it'd be very appropriate to talk with them again. Denise and Priscilla, can you please introduce yourself?
I'm Denise. I work for the Hair Story Project at the Office for the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth, and I'm also a student at York studying history and African studies.
My name is Priscilla, and I'm also a youth amplifier on the Hair Story Project, and I also attend York University for Latin American and Caribbean studies.
So I guess we should just start this conversation. Do you want to start it off, Josh?
Sure. So in your own way, like, how would you define the term black? And do you think there's some issues related to how some people in the black community define black and blackness?
When I think about that whole question, to be honest, on how do you define black, I find that it's a very hard question to answer, as everyone sees their blackness as in their own view. So there's multiple ways that you can see or define black. You have, and I think it's, you can also look at it as a categorized, where you have some racists who think this is what black is, and then you have black people who completely a different view on black. So to define the term black would be very difficult for me.
I personally think there are some personal issues and some society issues relating on basically the word black, and even as an individual being black and also being black in the black community. As Denise said, it is hard to define black. If you're supposed to ask me that, I could say, what does black mean to me? It's my identity, it's the color of that board over there. So basically you have a positive and negative, basically pro and cons to it. So I think there is some struggles, and there's still ways that we still need to communicate and work on to learn the term black.
Well, and I find the issue with how we define black. So there are folks out there who say, well, black is defined by the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And if that was so, like, that's where the issues of, like, shadism come in, and, like, some people get excluded because they're not so black, you know? And that's where you hear terms like light-skinned be thrown out there. And I find that often when we define black, it also comes with, like, a cultural idea of what black looks like. And so folks who talk a certain way can either be included in the term blackness or actually be excluded for it, which, like, for me, like, I think it's important, like, for me, the term black recognizes that within the group, while there is this struggle to figure out what that means, outside of this group, there are folks who use that term to discriminate against folks. And I think that's kind of what blackness, like, I think blackness means a whole range of things, but I think the one shared identifier is that, you know, folks in this community have experienced discrimination based on how people outside of that community have viewed them. And I think maybe, you know, within the community, if people focus more on that experience, there would be, like, there wouldn't be so much identity politics and being like, no, you're not black because you're this, this, and this, right? And, like, I understand that everyone has different ways of experiencing blackness and being black. Like, in our conversation in my podcast, I said my blackness is impacted by my gender as a man and is impacted by my sexual orientation as a gay man. And those aren't just things that operate in separately. They kind of, like, work together and they flow together. And I think a lot of people don't see it that way. They just see it as black. And, you know, and even in those communities where you have black gay men, you throw in class in there and the resources that people have. But I think for me, at least, like, the term black is the shared experience of racism. Like, I'm going to name it, like, the shared experience of racism. And that can come from within the group, and that can come outside of the group and folks who aren't black.
What's interesting is to hear you define black, and it kind of brings me back to, like, our Hair Story dialogues. Talking to youth in care, and you ask them, what is black identity? What does black mean to you? And it was, like, this whole question that is just, like, don't ask me that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be known as black.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to fit in.
Exactly.
And that's where it comes from, the racism outside of the group.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's looked at, if you look at the CAS system, it's predominantly white.
White, yeah.
So you're not trying to be black in this whole white system, right? So asking them, knowing that this is hair, so we're going to be focusing on this black piece
mm-hmm.
that's in you.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, do we really want to go there? No, mm-hmm. because, we're trying to fit in. We don't want that to be excluded mm-hmm. out of this CAS system. So it's pretty interesting to hear.
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, and it's funny that you say, it's not just the system is made from a white lens,
yeah.
but even the homes, so I was in care. I was in a white, I had white foster parents who actually used my race as a way to discriminate against me and my brother. And then I was adopted into a white home that growing up and the tensions that I have with those adopted parents now are very much related to the fact that, I was expected to change to that family. I was expected while being black to be culturally white. And, that could be questioned. But that was the point of it. And then, growing up when, I'd say to my parents, kids are saying this at school. My mom would just be like, sticks and stones. And it's just like, but what are you talking about, sticks and stones? This hurts me. And that's the thing, in a system like CAS, they don't educate parents on actually your family structure needs to change. Mm-hmm. Your worldview needs to change because you're about to bring in a child, whether it's a foster parent or an adoptive parent, you're about to bring a child into your home, and for you to support them means you have to be able to support their identity of who they are. And of course, you could throw that same thing for queer people and same thing for indigenous folk, mm-hmm. I'm happy you brought that up because, and I think that's the reason why black youth who are still in care don't want to talk about being black mm-hmm. because they've actually been trained by the system and by foster homes, group homes to not talk about it because I'm sure that they've tried to talk about it and have, it's somewhere along the line, someone said that's not important mm-hmm. or again, sticks and stones, right? They're not identifying that this is racism and it's super problematic.
And it's interesting, it's still the uncomfortable conversation
mm-hmm.
and we're in 2016.
Yeah.
The conversation needs to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do we make the conversation more comfortable? How do we get people to start having these conversations?
I don't think that's a real question. You just have to
have
the conversation. There's nothing. There's
just
no,
do it.
There's
is
no
what you're
way
saying.
I can structure it to make you feel comfortable. You have to accept that it's the reality in the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is what this group of people is facing.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you have to do to change it. This is what we all have to do in order so that everyone's able to fit in. I don't think there's a way mm-hmm. that you can make it comfortable.
Well, and I'm so sick and tired of, and you know what? It's every minority or discriminated groups, we're being told that we have to say things in a more comfortable manner so that way people are more willing to process it. I'm sorry. Black people were not comfortable during slavery. Black people are not comfortable being put in care. Black people are not comfortable being jobless. Black people are not comfortable being discriminated against when they go into stores.
Mm-hmm.
That is uncomfortable. So I'm sorry if our conversations about those experiences make you uncomfortable. But that's the thing. I have this professor who said, and I think it's super important for social workers, anyone out in the world, reality is we need to learn to sit in discomfort. We need to understand why we're uncomfortable, right? So folks who are uncomfortable with having this conversation, the reason is because they have to unpack things.
Mm-hmm.
They have to change their worldview. They have to understand that based on, for example, the color of their skin, they get certain privileges and are capable of doing certain things. Right. And so that's why I totally agree. That question, I don't have to do anything to make it more comfortable for you. In fact, I would rather make it more uncomfortable for folks so that way they have to think even more about what's going on.
So because it sounds like there's a lot of issues within the CES system,
mm-hmm.
right, in terms of identity and all that stuff. So are there ways, and this may be another loaded question, but are there ways to fix that? CES works from a cultural competency type of...
Well, not all the time.
They say they do, but
maybe they should be working more from a cultural humility perspective, right? And actually looking at the individual
mm-hmm.
and understanding their lived experiences. Because you guys did touch upon in saying that, black does mean something different for everyone
mm-hmm.
too, right? So using the cultural humility perspective allows I guess, the worker to actually see the person as an individual and how they define their worldviews or their identity.
It's interesting because you have a good point. That would definitely help because, like, when you, going back to the whole defining black, a lot of people think you're black, so you're Jamaican. Mm. Automatically. Mm-hmm. You're black, you're Jamaican.
Where are you from? Yeah. The Caribbean? Jamaica?
Yeah.
No.
Right? So people need to understand that there's more than just Jamaicans mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. black community. So getting to know the individual would help. But then at the same time, even before knowing the individual, I think the problem is that overrepresentation. Mm-hmm. It's that whole piece is mm-hmm. even before getting into the system, you need to look at the entry points mm-hmm. on how, why are they getting into the system? Why is a kid bringing a spicy beef patty yeah. a call to the CAS? Mm-hmm. It's in his culture. He's home. He's eating mm-hmm. spicy curry goat. I'm pretty sure it's in the culture, but mm-hmm. you don't understand that, oh, it's spicy. Oh my God, child abuse. That's yeah. called. And it goes also, just looking at it, I had to sit back and think, working on Hair Story, on the entry points, and a lot of it, I question, how do you define the term neglect? Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes, black kids are brought into CAS, it's because of this neglect piece. And I know growing up, my mom, you know, she had to work, nine to five mm-hmm. or there's other families who, you know, their mom's working a morning job, and after the morning job there's no time to go home, you're back at your second job for the mm-hmm. night. And as a parent, you make sure that your child's okay to stay in that home alone. Mm-hmm. I was told, don't go to the door, the doorbell ring, don't even go to the door, don't look to see who it is mm-hmm. because I'm not expecting anyone. Those were the rules. Don't answer the phone unless you see it's me. And it was just certain things where meal was left. And being home alone to CAS, that would be neglect. Because I know one of my friends, she left her son used to come home after school, and he would let himself into the house and wait till his mom gets home. Mm-hmm. In the back of me, that's nothing, like, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
You're 12, you can do it. Mm-hmm. You learn from a young age. I'm pretty sure you know how to cook, clean, and all of that already. And the neighbors saw that and were like, okay, this kid's coming home alone. And it was a quick call to CAS and police and CAS knocking at her door. It's just like, why? So that also creates that mistrust. So CAS is known as that, don't talk to me about CAS. Don't bring that conversation into the black community. We don't talk about CAS because they're known as those evil people who come knocking at your door, the police officers. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting.
Well, and it's just like, even in that conversation piece that you were just talking about, there's so many other things working in there. Like, okay, why? So if I was a CAS worker going in and being like, why is this mother not home, her child's not home? Oh, she's working and she can't afford the $1,000 it costs in Toronto for childcare. And do you know how much it costs to put a kid in CAS? Why are we not funding then childcare where those kids can just stay home with their family and not experience care? Because we know that the experience of care for many folks is not positive. And we know that on the other side of it, many statistics are saying we have made these people anti-citizens mm-hmm. by putting them in care. And, you know, and even in that, so it was funny that you're saying, you know, this kid, like children, and one of my other professors said, it's funny, when we view kids and children, we view them based on that. We actually don't see them as citizens holding rights based on citizens. We only see them holding rights based on children. What's problematic is who based those rights, right? And children should have rights, but it shouldn't just be based on them and their age category, right? So we actually deny children a lot of rights and young people a lot of rights based on their age, mm-hmm. right? And so that part of that's like the self-determination part. I'm sure a lot of children who, before going into care, while being in care, after care, through all of those points, said that they did not want to be in care. I would say a majority of them. I've never seen a statistic, I've never looked it up, but I'm sure that most kids who have been through it would say that. And it's ridiculous to then say, okay, but this is still a system that we're going to engage you with, and we're not going to change this system, and we're going to say we are. And you know, well, you know, we don't just go into homes, we don't discriminate against you because you're black. you're just neglecting your child. Okay, well, you made a standard that automatically discriminates against me based on my income. Mm-hmm. You made a standard that automatically discriminates against me based on my cultural background. And instead of, for example, providing, you know, income supplements, and instead of providing, say, educational supports based on, you know, I hate saying that, like, here in Canada piece, but, like, here in Canada, you know, you can't do these things to your kids because that's not how we see punishment. You know, that's an education piece that you could take forward and keep the kid in the home. And the reality is, if we're talking just based on financial, that is a cheaper option, mm-hmm. and it's probably a more healthier and productive option for the child. And then there was one, like, the cultural competency part and the cultural humility. There's one word that I learned was cultural safety, and I think this comes specifically from Indigenous folks who critiqued the cultural competency model. And they said the cultural safe aspect is, you know, allowing individuals to have their own voice and to speak and listen to their stories, and then you take out of their stories and not generalize it. Because I think what also happens is we say, well, this is just an individual. This is just happening to an individual. You know, if we take, for example, a lot of Black children in care, and care being kids in care, because the reality is not everyone in the Caribbean is Black by physiology, but how they come to Canada and how Canada understands Blackness, their cultures understood as Black, and therefore they still face some of the discrimination that a Black person would, and a lot of statistics show that. So we know that those folks actually share an experience based on many things. Okay, so we have to let them tell their stories and engage with that. And that's my piece where, like, you know, a lot of these kids would say they don't want to be in care. So engage with their stories, but then generalize it. Like, okay, we have a huge group of kids saying they don't like this. Then let's take this and, you know, safely use this as a tool. Because I think the issue with the cultural competency model is, like, you assume that you can learn about a culture. Like, culture is not static. It's always fluid. Mm-hmm. Culture changes based on who's considered a part of that culture or not. So that's so problematic. And that's not to say, no, like, I think what should be happening is people are being educated on the experiences of the Black community, the experience of the Caribbean community, and the experience of so many communities that have engaged with CAS and other forms of oppression that come from systems set here in Canada. That's important. And especially, like, with Indigenous people, you know, it's very important that people learn the education piece. And to learn the principles of those cultures, right? So Indigenous people did have and still do have certain ways of knowing and being. And Caribbean culture and Caribbean community and Black communities do have certain ways of knowing, right? So, for example, you look at a lot of racialized communities. Community is a very important piece. Whereas, you know, you look at the downtown core, which is very predominantly white, culturally, visually, right? It's very individual. And so those are pieces that you can take away, especially, like, if I was going to go into a community and take out a child, how does taking that child out of that community, how does that not just impact the child, how does that impact the community? And so right now there's a lot of fear in the Black community and a lot of other communities that engage with CAS. They're scared. For example, you know, mothers and families that experience violence are afraid to call the police because they know that they are more likely to have their child taken away from them if they are racialized, right? So, and that's a problem because now this person doesn't have access to safety or justice.
Yeah. It sounds like there needs to be a whole revamp of the system to be more cultural, I don't know, aware, or, like, understanding what it means in the community, in different types of community. But I like what you said, Denise, about, like, redefining, like, what neglect is and what that looks like. And it just reminded me of a paper that I wrote way back about corporal punishment and how in the Black community, when corporal punishment's used, it has a little bit more positive impacts on the young person compared to corporal punishment used on white people. Because corporal punishment is seen not positive, but it's seen as like just as a punishment in more in the Black community. In the white community, it seems like it's very bad, like you're abusing your kid type of thing, right? So it was very interesting to read that it's the perceptions are different and the impact it has on the young person's different. So I think it's important to have those conversations, and those conversations need to be had more about how do we redefine neglect, because how that looks like in different communities, I think it's different.
Well, and I think that's based on the child's perception, mm-hmm. right? Like I don't even want to say that, because like not everyone in the Black community uses corporal punishment, right? And that's like it's a stereotype. Yeah. However, like going off that, if you've learned your entire life that your parent shouldn't be and couldn't be using corporal punishment, of course it's going to have a more negative impact on you, because you've learned that they shouldn't be doing that. But if you know that it's a part of your culture and it's normalized, and it's not like, I don't want to say corporal punishment's safe, but the reality is like you're not beating your kid to death. Like there's a difference between corporal punishment mm-hmm. and beating, right?
And that's not to say that kids who are put into care
are bad.
They're getting beat. There are kids who do come from those seriously abusive mm-hmm. homes, but then you have those kids who, if your mom's spanking you, did something wrong, you know. Like, it's just in you.
Yeah.
You were raised with this, you know, you're never doing that again.
Yeah. Because that whooping,
no. And you learn right away that, nope, I'm not going to do that again. And it was never seen as, oh, my God, I'm getting beat. Let me go pick up the phone and call somebody. My mom's abusing me.
You know, I even heard, like, in the Caribbean community, like, some moms would be like, go ahead, call him. Call him. Go ahead. Here's their number, right? Because that's the thing. And, like, even in the case of, like, those who get taken of very abusive homes, you were taking them out of abusive homes and putting them in a very abusive system, right? So you're actually furthering the trauma, because, you know, it doesn't end. Like, very few folks actually go into the system and come out the other side without having a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm saying, like, neglect, abuse. And the thing is, we don't want to think of it this way, because then we have to think of children and youth as having agency and thought, right? Mm-hmm. You have to ask the children, you know, did your parents spanking you, you know, did that really scare you? Yeah. I'm sure no kid is like, yeah, I was loving that, right? So we know that the normal reaction is to be scared. But did you learn from, like, you know, asking the kid, did you learn from it? How often does it happen?
It's the further question.
Yeah.
But they take the first answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You were scared.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, he was a beast. Mm-hmm. He was scared for his life. Oh, my God, we need to take him out of this home.
Are you scared of your parents now that they've done that? No. Why? Probably because you've learned from it, right? You're just scared of ever doing that again. Like, and that's different, right? Because we have forms of punishment set up in society to deter people from doing that. That is a cultural deterrent. I don't even say in the Black community, in many communities, is corporal punishment as we've defined it, right? And most often, I'm sure if you said, okay, child, you got spanked, you didn't like it. You have two options. You can stay here, learn from that, not do it again, you don't get spanked. Or we're gonna put you in a system where when you come out on the other side, you are more likely to end up in jail, you are more likely to be uneducated, you are more likely to be homeless. What do you wanna do? Right? But that is having to believe that a child has agency and voice.
Yeah, it sounds like there's have you guys heard of the term adultism?
No.
So adultism is basically, it's kind of like reverse ageism. So it's saying that adults know better than the child or the youth.
Yeah.
Adults make the decision for the child or youth. They don't like really consider their voices. So it's exactly what you're touching upon, Josh. And it sounds like the system is very much built with that adultism, adult-centric lens that we know better than children. Because we're adults, and if that like superiority, authority, power, all that stuff is in there. And it sounds like that we need to be listening more to children and youth and what their experiences are and what impacts them and what do they actually want instead of adults making the decision. Yeah.
And I think it's the way you listen to youth, because you can have those workers who go in and will con you to say something that's going to mm-hmm. mess up your family, you know what I mean? And oftentimes, you often hear the story where, you know, a mom is caught because her kid's in the office. You know, CS is there. You're coming from work. Obviously, guns are blazing. Mm-hmm. These people have my child. I wonder what they're interrogating him. Because yeah. you know what's going to happen. And you go in there, guns blazing, and it's the stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Angry yeah, black mother. Yeah, oh. there we go. Here we got get. Another one.
Yeah. So she's probably abusive. Okay, mm-hmm. here we go. And it's just checking off the list.
Yeah, and it's like, no, you check off scared as hell, you're going to take her kid. Yeah. Why don't you put that down, right? Because I've never heard of a parent being like, okay. Right? And even, like, they even say that the most abusive parents are not keen on having their child taken away because it does not matter. That is your child, and that is happening, right? And it just... Like, and it bugs me because, when you brought up the adultism thing, mm-hmm. it made me think that the people who probably set up these standards probably have never experienced abuse. They're probably some privileged kid who got punished by their parent for being an idiot, and then, you know, they got reprimanded. And so now they're adults, and like, I didn't like that. I'm not going to let it happen again. And you know what? And I'd say, like, you look at the people who set up our laws. Those are the people that are the most privileged people. The people who set up mandates and policies, those are the most privileged people.
People who are not.
But if you were to go to the communities and say, you know, this is what's happening in your community. What do we do to fix it? What's a way to keep children safe? Okay, well, give me funding so I can put my kid in childcare. Educate me in ways that may help me understand how I can help my child understand when not to do things without having to use corporal punishment, right? Give me resources. But that is a harder fix than just putting a law in place and apprehending a kid. And then even in your story, like, you have workers coming in. Let's name who that worker is. It is a white woman, right? We know that. There's a white woman going in, and that's not to say, you know, racialized individuals aren't a part of that, but they're forced to be a part of that. Exactly. Like, you don't get to go in to CAS and try to cause change. You just get fired, yeah. right? So at the risk of your job, you're going to do that? No, you're going to follow along, but it just impacts you more to do that. Whereas there are a lot of people who go to work to CAS because in their mindset it's, I'm going to stop these awful parents from hurting their mm-hmm. kids.
But they're not awful.
Exactly. And they don't even consider the whole story. They don't even consider a story. They just go in with their lens and they're like, and I've heard of like parents having this experience and they're just like, before they even asked a question, I could tell what they were going to do. They could read the social worker.
I don't know, I'm just sitting here, like, thinking back and forth, but to actually think deeper, I know the one thing that we need to do as a community is to have a conversation mm-hmm. and talk about it, but we've already done that.
Yeah.
So what's next? I think even though we do a lot of talking and we do a lot of figuring out and try mm-hmm. to do it, it still won't change anything. I'm not trying to be negative. It just goes by the books.
Yeah.
And as Josh said, it's someone who created these laws or these procedures or et cetera, you name it. That needs to be changed first because, for example, social workers have to abide by what's in mm-hmm. the book. Don't matter if you're black, white. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I had a white worker. She's obviously going to abide by the book. I had a black worker. She was a little off edge, mm-hmm. but all she said to me is, Priscilla, I have to go by the book. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, it refers back to that law. Who do we mm-hmm. talk to? Because it's all of us having this conversation mm-hmm. or grabbing the youth together or parents having a conversation in their homes mm-hmm. or getting the training. We could have all of that. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But we can't sign off and say, but like, you know, like, do you get what I'm saying? So
yeah.
it's moving to that next level and figuring out, okay, there's yeah. obviously a problem in the black community. There's obviously a problem outside the black community. Right, and obviously racism is still
Well, I think that's the thing, is Canada actually does not want to acknowledge that racism is a big problem in Canada. They're willing to look at America and be like, we're not like America. They're willing to acknowledge that there's an issue with Indigenous people. And I was having this conversation with someone that actually Black people have now just like reached like an all-time, like,
we're done.
No one's looking at us because we don't have cops shooting us in the street. We don't have cops arresting us in violent ways and it being caught on tape. So everyone, the citizens, are looking at Canada and then and being like, no, we're better than America. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, Canada has always been very implicit and quiet about how they do things, right?
Quiet racism.
And that's the thing, like, where's our Royal Commission on Black peoples in Canada? Right? Where's our Royal Commission on Black families in Canada? We don't have that. And, you know, that's the thing. That's the point. The government is supposed to do that because then they're supposed to be getting policy recommendations and then they're supposed to make policy and make policy change. Yeah. You know, and they didn't do it with the Indigenous people when they had the Royal Commission on Aboriginal peoples in Canada. And so now they have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And, you know, and we have a government saying, we are willing to take your advice. Now let's see how that works out. But Black people haven't even made it to the beginning of that process. We haven't even been let down the first time.
Exactly.
Like, we haven't even had that process. We're just not acknowledged.
It sounds like, in general, like, it's all systemic. Like, I'm just going to bring it generally to, like, minority groups and everything, that people making the policy, and I'm in school for this, so I'm going to get, like, slapped with all my peers listening to this later. But people making the policy do not understand the day-to-day experiences. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They don't get it. They don't. And, you know, I try to bring that into the class sometimes and saying that I understand the reason why policies have to be general. Mm-hmm. I understand why certain language has to be used. But there is, and it's across the board. It's in, you know, the disability community. It's in any minority community. It's that policies are impacting them in a negative way because there's no understanding of the day-to-day experiences. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be a cultural shift. There has to be a government shift, a public sector shift into the thinking that we have to be more collaborative with society. Mm-hmm. When we make policies, we have to ask the communities that the policy is impacting their opinion. If I'm writing a policy that's going to be impacting, I don't know, children with disabilities or the Black community or whatever, I need to be asking them, making sure that, because I'm going to miss something. Mm-hmm. I'm only a small piece of the community. I'm part of a minority community. I'm part of the disability community. But that's only one piece, right? Mm-hmm. So I may be able to write policy that's going to try to impact the disability community in a positive way, but I won't get it from the Black community perspective. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be that huge shift in thinking in how, like, the public sector is run now.
Well, and I think that's the thing, is like, we don't take policy does not take an intersectional mm-hmm. approach. It does not, for example, two-spirited LGBTQ, there's no 2S. That has been slapped on somewhere at the end, right? Time. So we've already excluded Indigenous people and said, okay, like, I guess we can end you on. But the reality is, no one has looked at the Black experience of LGBTQ other than, you know, racialized LGBTQ folk who are like, screw you, that was not my experience. Mm-hmm. Right? And here's the thing. It is because in a policy domain, Blackness is not sexy right now. Mm-hmm. That is not the sexy topic right now. And this is not to romanticize the racism, colonialism, sexism, and all the forms of oppression people face. It is just that it's called a policy window, you know, and right now the policy window is for Indigenous people, mm-hmm. especially with the release of the TRC. Yeah. And unfortunately, what that does is that takes away from the policy window of so many other groups. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the reality is beforehand, Black people did not have a policy window. Right now, we do not have a policy window. And because our Canadian culture is not like the American culture where we have cops doing this, that, and the other thing, I don't see a policy window coming into the future until there is a crisis where something happens with a Black person. Mm-hmm. Where a Black life does not matter and gets taken away by someone within the system, and that was the only window I see. And it is so problematic to think that the only time an issue can be addressed in the Black community is when someone dies.
To add on to that, I personally think there's not going to be a day where no Black lives, like, our lives don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's always going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to see where there be a day in this life where one day we don't matter. Because at the end of the day, it's still open, it's still ongoing, mm-hmm. and it's like we're always pushed to the side and mm-hmm. we come back again.
Yeah.
As you said, someone would die in the community or blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. So it's...
It's hard. I don't know, like, it's hard because, like, and even then, like, when we come back, we don't come back. Like, we come back as a community almost. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's kind of like, and it's like, it's like, and it's that talking aspect. And it's like you said, we never make it to the next step because we get forgotten and we get pushed back yeah. out. And it's like, it's, and it's not our fault. Like, I would say black people are everywhere now. We are in academics. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't make it into the prime minister's cabinet. Notice that one, right? Yeah. So, and we're struggling to make it into government. But, so that's the thing. Like, we are doing everything that we can. But we're, I would say, systemically, everything is put in place to yeah. stop
look
us.
At the, look at the Grammys.
Yeah, look at the Grammys, oh, yeah. the Oscars, right?
The Grammy nominations. Mm-hmm. Halle Berry was the first...
Black
woman to win, mm-hmm. and after that, it has not been. And look at the nominees
yeah.
now.
It's yeah.
all white actors.
Oh, but you have BET awards, like. Oh, but
it's not,
yeah, it's so and yeah. it's so funny. But like, and that's the thing. Like, right now in society of the law, and I've had so many conversations. For some reason, the only time blackness gets considered is when we are put in a stereotypical role of entertainment. So I guess. Moving forward for both of you, like, how would you see that, like, how would advocacy look for you, let's say, in this issue? Like, how can we take this forward in an advocacy role? And how would you do that, maybe personally, or how would you want to see that seen?
I think for me, the most important thing is that whole, what sticks to me is that whole conversation on being comfortable and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Screw it. Get comfortable. Mm-hmm. We're gonna have this conversation. And I think mm-hmm. that's just needs to happen, and we need to stop beating around the bush and stepping on tippy toes yeah. around the let's have the conversation, and just that's where it has to start, where everybody can have the conversation, not just the black community. Mm-hmm. Everybody join in the black community and listen to that black community.
I think that's a good way to end, Denise. Does anyone have any last thoughts before we wrap up? No?
Oh,
we're
no.
good. I think we have touched upon everything. So thank you again to Denise and Priscilla for taking their time out to talk with me and Josh. So your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. If you are a child or youth and you would like to be on the show, or if you have a topic that you think we should be talking about, please email me and Josh at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.